Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Vanity Fair.
Time is a flat circle, and we are all stuck in it.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Hillary Busis. We are here to discuss the final episode, Part 6, Season 4, HBO's True Detective, Night Country.
And later on, the one and only Jodie Foster. I guess we haven't really said her name that much on this podcast.
Well, because we use character names on this podcast.
This is true.
Yeah, we always remember to call her Danvers and not Jodie Foster.
Liz Danvers, Elizabeth Danvers, will be dropping by our very own podcast to talk about the big reveal of the episode and talk about filming this great show.
So stay tuned for that. But first, we're going to do a recap. Spoilers ahead, all you West Coast folks, if this is in your feed and you haven't watched the episode yet, bail out now. Or maybe you're weird like that and you just want to, you just want to be spoiled before you, like reading the Wikipedia of a horror movie before you see it.
It is spooky, so I can understand the impulse.
Anyway, consider yourself warned. So it's a dark and stormy night and Navarro and Danvers break into the ice caves. They discover an underground lab and a missing scientist.
Oh, trapped.
Raymond Clark is interrogated and reveals that the scientists in a group killed Annie Kay.
You don't understand. The project could have saved so many lives.
They stabbed her 32 times.
Clark commits suicide by running into the blizzard, and Navarro and Danvers wrestle their own demons on the ice. But as the storm lifts, they discover a clue on a door hatch that unlocks the mystery.
We weren't asking the right question. The question isn't who killed Annie Kay. Who knows who killed her?
Danvers and Navarro confront the killers, the cleaning staff, and learn how they pulled it off. You know, if there was a murder to solve, that is.
We just swung by to inform you that the forensics came back. Cause of death is a slab avalanche. This case is officially closed. Thought you'd want to know, seeing as they were your employers and all.
And Navarro disappears, but first takes down the mining company.
So those reports of sightings of her, they may be true?
Well, Mrs. Ennis, nobody ever really leaves.
Well, it was kind of the town all along.
Yeah.
Like, in a kind of great way, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, the truest detective was the friends we made along the way.
Oh, 100%.
Are we satisfied?
I didn't see it coming.
No. I didn't see it coming. I think satisfied is a complicated question.
Right.
Ooh,
right.
Say more.
I love sisters doing it for themselves. Mm-hmm. I love vigilante justice. I think there is something.
I'm just going to clip that and like.
Don't use that against
me. I'm recording of you saying that to the police.
Do not use my words against me. I absolutely
stand
that.
Are you the Batman?
I will say it strained credulity a little bit. Just the whole the whole ending. I guess we should say, basically, the Native women in the town who worked in Salal and who cleaned it and cut their
hair. Were mistreated, ignored. Yeah.
Banded together and stormed in and humiliated and some amazing, you know, not to kink shame, but really sort of humiliated these men, stripped them naked, took them out to the tundra and just left them there and said, you know, if Annie wants them to live, they'll live. If Annie wants them dead, they'll die. And guess what? They die.
Annie is embodiment of this sort of bigger earth spirit. Yeah,
like that now she is part of that spirit. And Annie, who in fact was killed by the scientists.
Yes, who was killed by these men. And all of them.
Yes.
There
was one after the other. It was a murder on the Orient Express kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I found that such a fascinatingly complex thing because on the one hand, in the immediate, this work can only be done by further destroying this town. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you think bigger picture, if these scientists were right, we're talking about like cancer cures. We're talking about millions, if not billions, of people. Obviously, you can't kill people now to save people later.
That is the argument of the villain in Dan Brown's Inferno.
But
which you ghostwrote
is so, actually on my bookshelf.
Right.
The thing is, I thought that was actually probably one of the strongest parts of the episode for me, because that is such an American way, sacrificing people in the moment for progress. That's slavery, right? Taking people in the present moment for, you know, product and to progress and to get more and more and more and get closer to this amorphous thing that will save.
Well, and for the promise of like an uncertain future right?
That will be better for, that they say it's going to be better for everybody, but is it actually better for anybody? Right. And for the people who are harmed in the present, it's awful and terrible. So I thought that sort of parallel to, you know, we talked a lot, I guess, at the beginning of this season about, you know, the original sin of America, you know, the white people versus the indigenous people, the native people. So having the women sort of rally back and murder all these men who were doing this thing that could potentially maybe benefit the world, but completely decimates the town and is awful. I thought that was actually one of the better parts of the episode.
And there's also like a neat mirroring between, you know, Annie's murder at the hands of this cabal of men and then like the, like her community coming too. So it's, you know, there's two group murders.
Two group murders.
And I think it was really crucial that we had an episode open with Annie Kay alive and helping to birth this baby and clearly positioning her at a very necessary center of this, you know, mistreated, under, you know, resourced community. That even, like, I don't know what this group of women, how much they knew about what research the scientists were doing or, like, what Annie had destroyed or not. The fact of the matter is they just robbed them of this vital person in their world and did it callously and got away with it forever. And, you know, and I think that, do we understand what the sort of breaking point was, like why they decided to do it after all these years?
I think wasn't it that...
Because they had found out
They had
recently?
Found out because the mop water, it falls, and then it sinks into the ice cave.
Mm-hmm. And she finds the device.
And she finds the device that killed Annie. Yeah. So then they were like, this is where... Because she was like, I didn't know for 6 years.
Because there were these various...
So it's specifically because of Annie.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Or because they finally found out, conclusively who killed her.
I did notice, I don't remember if it was this episode or last week, but like when Navarro's in a laundromat, the woman who's missing part of her fingers, she is like kind of walks by in the background and they kind of, and she's like in focus. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, and then just like visually them being like, let's put her back in your head because it had been a while. And it's a big secret for a lot of people to hold.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But it's a really like deep, deep, you know, we're fucked if anyone tells kind of secret. So maybe that was enough to bind it to them and they didn't tell anyone. Although toward the end of the episode, they're like, whatever. We don't care.
It's kind of amazing how quickly they're like, yeah, we did it.
Yeah, we did it. Yeah.
It was an oral if I did it. It was I mean, were we to be involved?
Very OJ Simpson.
It might have gone like this. Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, which also feels the way that Danvers isn't really like invited into the sisterhood, but she is, you know, given some guardianship over the secret and they're trusting her to keep it.
Yes, exactly. Which I think is enough for gruff, mean white woman in that community. You know, she has helped bring some sort of justice by the lack of it.
Yes.
And I will say it's kind of fitting and kind of nice that the fake excuse that Kate McKittrick came up with, like, oh, it was a slap avalanche, actually exonerates the women who
because
murdered them.
I don't think Kate knew shit about shit in terms of who killed the scientists. She just didn't want them in that cave.
She just didn't want them in that cave. Yeah. So it's
joke's
on you, Kate.
Although there is still, the women say they didn't leave the tongue behind.
Yes.
Is that ever answered?
Is there just, there actually is maybe some supernatural force?
Well, there is a moment when Danvers is looking at the floor at where the tongue was found and seems sort of like mesmerized by it. And then Navarro kind of interrupts her and then we don't go back to that moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then we just find out sort of at the end that like the group of women are, I don't think she was being like cheeky when she was like, that wasn't us. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Cheeky. Tongue in cheek.
Oh, there we go. Whoops. Yeah. I think that is Issa Lopez being like, who knows what this explanation is.
Well, because it's still like, we see them abandon the men and they're naked and everything, but like, does that explain why they like claw their eyes out? Does that explain why their eardrums are burst? Does that explain why they're in one big clump when they die? Like, there are still elements of it that point to some kind of magic.
I was trying to game that out in my head. It's like, okay, so they run into the night. It's dark. They get disoriented. They don't even know how to get back, which direction their clothes are. They've had guns pointed at them. Maybe when they start to get very, very cold, they start kind of huddling for warmth and
together.
It kind of turns into a sort of like Hieronymus Bosch-esque, kind of thing. Also, some of it was just for style for the show,
We don't have to be too precious.
But I think you're right, Hillary, that like basically they say like, we're going to send them out. Their clothes are back here. If she wants to take them, she can. And it seems like maybe she wanted to take them and have them really suffer before she did, you know. And as something of a warning to all others who might transgress in that way. So I liked how it sort of operatically fit the themes of the show, this reveal. But I also kind of think, I wish that some of these women in this group had been a little more present in the show.
Yes, that was...
You think that the show is just too coy about them?
Yeah. I mean, spoiler alert for Mayor of Easttown, but like it's a bit like Julian Nicholson's son. And you're like, he was in like a few scenes, guys. Like that feels a little like cheating.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
I know that these shows are not built like an Agatha Christie. We're not supposed to be watching trying to figure out who did it and all the answers are in front of us. But like, I guess, but didn't Lopez say that like...
That you would be able to figure it out, or not necessarily that you would be able to figure it out, but that like... The answer is not hidden, that like it is possible to figure it out by just paying attention.
And I think that's fair.
I think that it's possible.
It's possible if you think that we do see that this is a community that takes care of itself, that they're self-reliant, that they are there for each other with the births and the stillbirth funerals.
We caught on to the fact that there was some element of revenge to the scientist's death.
Right.
So we can see it. But I do, again, it didn't feel random and it didn't feel unjustified, but I do understand. I do feel similarly to Richard in that I would have liked to know these women a little bit more if they're the reason. I feel like we spent more time with the scientists than with.
But then that does give you like the Westworld problem where it's like this mystery is easily solved from watching at the very beginning. And then when the show gets to its big reveal, you're like, I knew that.
I guess I want my cake and to eat it too.
Yeah. Right. You want it to be surprising but satisfying.
Yeah.
But logical.
But also logical.
Was it logical that someone in like negative, I don't even know what temperatures, could fall into, I don't know, how cold water.
And then be fine.
And be
like wear a blanket
after
for a
few
little
hours.
Bit.
Like that felt like when Danvers fell into the water, I was like,
that's it.
That's an interesting way for her to go, but I think that would have to be it.
Some very like beautifully shot.
It was gorgeous. That was a gorgeous
teased
scene.
In the opening credits.
Exactly. Yeah.
Look, I don't want to be CinemaSins about it. Like, okay, whatever. She got to her in time. She got her warm enough. It was fine. We had talked last week about worrying that Navarro was going to die because what does she really have? Her sister's gone. She's feeling this entity calling to her, and it seemed to almost do that. But then, maybe we've seen this in things before, but I liked the way it was handled here, that she had to save someone in order to save herself, and I thought that was kind of a nice way to put Navarro and Danvers together without having them become like the best of friends, because the season ends with Navarro. I mean, what did you guys make of that ending where like she's on the porch? What was she really, or was that sort of representative?
I don't think that we were supposed to. When she was walking out into the tundra, I feel like first I was like, wait, is she pulling a Juliet? But then I was like, wait, no, that's just a beautiful shot. I can understand why they would have that. It's just pretty to look at. So I think that she literally skipped town and got out, because remember, people know that she killed Wheeler. Like, that is people that we haven't seen.
That information's out there.
That information is out there, so it's probably not a safe place for her to be, really, at this point, especially now that the mine is in trouble and is probably going to shut down, which it ends up shutting down. So I saw that as, you know what, they were out of Ennis. That was not, because that wasn't Jodie, it didn't look like Jodie Foster's. They were on a lake somewhere.
Yeah.
I think they were back further south in Alaska, maybe just like having a weekend
away. It could be someplace where it's maybe not night.
Yeah, where it's not night all the time. I was like, oh, they got out, if only for briefly for Danvers, but Navarro maybe for good.
Yeah.
And they are together in a gorgeous place that isn't Ennis.
Yeah.
And that's what I took. Isn't that nice?
It was crazy just having any daylight on the show. Wasn't it?
It's like, that's what they actually look like. Yeah.
That's what the landscape looks like. I mean, I know it was Iceland, but like, I don't know. I just thought that was fascinating.
Yeah.
Something else. I know that we were so worried about Navarro and these visions and her supernatural tendencies and whether that would lead to her doom, but it actually sort of led to a homecoming, a really important moment with her learning her native name, and that I wasn't expecting that.
Mm-hmm.
That really did sort of touch my heart, and I wasn't expecting it.
Yeah, no, it's meaningful, and the meaning of her name also is obviously feels very, like, weighted with meaning, and it is Return of the Sun After a Long Darkness, which, you know, is what will presumably happen in Ennis someday.
Well, who's to say?
If we're not, in fact, in nighttime forever in hell. But yeah, no, it's a nice moment. It brings her arc to a nice end, takes her kind of full circle, and yeah, makes you hope that whatever's in store for her in the future, there will be some light.
It is, in some senses, what she went there to find. And then when she finds it, she can leave again.
Yes.
You know, and go out back into the world and not be haunted by so many things.
And it also sort of was helpful in a literal way to getting to the bottom of the Salal murders, because once she was able to introduce herself to the native women with her native name, that was the...
Right. That's the missing piece.
That's the missing piece. And then they were like, oh, we trust you. We can share this story with you and let
you into
this community. So it actually ended up having real consequences, positive consequences on the case itself. So
we never would have gotten to that point. We never would have gotten the answers without that.
Yeah. So I thought that was really well done and a nice sort of bow on that sometimes really scary storyline with Navarro.
And Pryor is what? He's okay, kind of? I think that, well, Rose says to him, you know, when they put the bodies in the sea, she's like, you think the worst part's over, about to be over. She's like, it's not, and it is horrible every day. And so, like...
How many men has Rose killed?
Yeah. You know,
that's a good old
over how many
question.
Centuries?
That's True Detective Season 5.
Yeah. Who really is Rose? I mean, when was she a professor? Like, you know, Pryor is about as good as one can be on a True Detective show.
Yes.
Like, he's broken and did a horrible thing, but at least he's has a family and
I will say,
he survived.
Thank you to Issa Lopez of having Pryor clean up the blood in his tidy whities, as one would do naturally.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
How else? In your, you know,
you don't want to leave evidence on your clothes.
I also liked a little bit of suspense like that. This sort of like, oh, there's a tooth in the wall, and I have to like cover it up because Leah just showed up. Like a little bit of sort of a different kind of show or movie where there's kind of a scramble to cover up a crime. Like, I appreciated it that Lopez added that in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I also have to wonder if she's an Elena Ferrante fan or a Olivia Colman fan, because Navarro's mother peels oranges in one long strip.
In one long
strip. Like in The Lost Daughter.
Which looks like a circle, too.
Which is a spiral.
Yeah. No, the oranges thing is, yeah, lots of little, like, callbacks to things we'd seen earlier in the season. It really did feel like a sort of grand vision. It didn't feel by the end that Lopez was like making it up as she went, like where she wrote each episode. You know, it's like there was clearly a grand vision.
Yes,
here.
It's tight. It's constructed with thought, which is nice to see, and not always the case in a show like this.
Yeah, even for True Detective, kind of admirably abstract in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it's not just the tongue thing, but it's sort of like even the sort of thematic swirl of it. Like, there are different sort of arguments and themes sort of mingling with each other, but nothing is sort of too neatly tied in a bow. And like, we get some justice in that the mining thing shuts down, but the show is not saying that
it's all
that, oh yay, the heroes won, you know, forever. I like its sort of ambivalence and ambiguity.
Mm-hmm. And you can even see that in, like, you know, when Clark is telling them the story of what purportedly happened to Annie, he leaves out the very important detail that he is the one who actually did kill her in the
right.
end.
Yes.
Right. Right.
Like, there is still kind of, the show is still taking pains to differentiate between the stories that people are telling and this objective truth, which we do get, I mean, at least we think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, can we talk about Clark for a bit and Clark's death, too?
Mm-hmm.
So, we're expected to believe that he got free and just was like, I'm out. I'm just going to go into the tundra. Or did Navarro bring him out and kill him in a rage?
I think Navarro has a problem not killing these guys who did a bad thing that she's mad at, yeah. You know? Yeah, but that was not the clearest to me because it's like, but that's the case. Like,
that's the case. Why would you murder him when he has the case?
But it turns out, well, I guess because Clark doesn't know who killed the men. He assumes it was the ghost of Annie Kay. So, like, it's not like, you know, inadvertently Navarro protected the women who did it because otherwise Clark would have said something. So I don't know.
I mean, he's clearly not all there.
No.
Like,
I don't think you could be after
it's
that.
It's not maybe so out of line to think that he would just have had it and just go into the, and, you know, he's being, you know, driven crazy by, like, these voices and maybe by
Annie Kay's screams.
Right, and whatever actual spirit there is out there on the tundra. And so, yeah, maybe he did. It's maybe not the best, the best ending for him.
I have another bone to pick with Clark and how that sort of went down. Totally fine that he's, like, in the caves or whatever, and then he could have probably murdered Navarro with the fire extinguisher, smacking her across the head. Mm-hmm. Seemed pretty hard. Yeah. Then he's dragging her, and I know that we established this in the first scene with Navarro that she can beat up any guy that she wants to, but to cut from Navarro being dragged on the ground and then Jody running in and then Navarro is pinning him down and beating the shit out of him. I'm like, I would have liked to see the fight choreography that went into the moment where she came to, got him on the ground and wasn't like in charge. She was just almost knocked. She was knocked out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's fair.
That was a little convenient.
Yeah, I can accept that. I mean, as convenient as Danvers somehow surviving that fall, she's pretty deep under that water.
Yeah.
But she
loves swimming. Yeah. Jodie Foster loves swimming. We know that.
Yeah. Although speaking of ambiguity, I guess we still don't entirely know how Holden died. Like, it's a car accident. Was it her fault? Was it somebody else's fault?
It seems like no, because she walks out sort of draped in a blanket of some
kind. But she said he was trapped in the car, and she's like, was he calling for me? Was he scared? You know, whatever. And
was it her husband?
But I like that they didn't
say more than that.
Because I think that her giving the full exposition of what happened in that moment would have been bad writing.
Yeah. Well, it's like, why would she be telling Navarro this now? Like, Navarro already knows.
Yeah, there's no reason.
I think just using that sort of shorthand of, like, you know what happened, but I just wonder about him in that car. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's enough, and I think that what the show did smartly was, like, I got a little bit nervous toward the beginning that, like, okay, like, Navarro has this grief and this anger, and Danvers has this grief and this anger. It's a little too close together and, like, whatever. I just thought that there was going to be some big, big cathartic healing moment about Holden or whatever. And it's like, no, that's not involved in this. This is just something that she's sad about, and both of these women are struggling to figure out how to be alive.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, and they do through each other, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. That being said, I agree with that. Not to counter that, but I did appreciate that we got a little glimpse of, like, Leah and Danvers having a burger at the end. So having, like, that,
But that wasn't overdone, you know?
No, it wasn't
simple
overdone.
Stuff. It was, like, little things.
It's a little thing being like, oh, they are ultimately okay.
Yeah.
And, like, maybe are going to find a way to a new closeness.
Yes.
And in the present tense of the show, Leah comes back home being like, well, my mom told me to be here for New Year's, so where is she? And it just kind of ends with her leaving a voicemail being like, I hope you come back, or don't die out there. I'm glad that Lopez spared us the tearful reconciliation.
Have to be more, you know? It doesn't have to be bigger than that.
The idea of coming back was such a theme of this episode, because that's also what Kwavik says to Evangeline, to Navarro as well, that you can go out there into the distance, into danger. But if you come back, that's what matters.
Well, but then you also have, you know, at the end, Danvers saying, this is Ennis, nobody ever really leaves. And, like, that's kind of sweet, but it's also very ominous. It's like, you can't die, you can't leave. Like, you are always going to be, like, haunting this place.
Yeah.
And that's horrible. Then it's you know, it's purgatory. It's not even hell.
Yeah, I think I like all that sort of. I thought the end with the music and the filming was beautiful and moving in a way to see these people not in at least immediate distress. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right, Hillary. Like, there's some ominous conclusions as well.
Speaking of the conclusions, I guess having talked through it, and this is one of those things where it in some ways it felt satisfying in the moment, in some ways it didn't feel satisfying in the moment. After talking about it, I actually think I feel better about certain aspects of the ending in terms of the Native women coming together and killing the Salal men. But now other things are sort of sticking in my craw. The fact that we just never saw Connelly again. We never saw...
Yeah, although there are also things I think that are wrapped up in a neater way that I would have necessarily thought. Like, I think it's pretty easy for, you know, the mine funds Salal, so therefore Salal is going to, like, fudge the pollution numbers. But it's, I think, slightly more interesting and less expected to have Clark say, well, actually, the pollution
is helping
our work. Like, I don't think that that's something, like, you know, science.
That pollution is slavery. That pollution is imperialism. Yeah. That is the pollution. Yeah. Sorry, I can't get over that metaphor.
You're literally on your pulpit right now.
The way I'd be writing a thesis about this in college. Wait, can we talk about the music, which we haven't really talked about?
No.
We really should talk about the music, because we get something that we probably should have noticed with from the Billie Eilish of it all, of the contemporary cool song. There were a lot of moments of sort of these deep, scary interpolations of, like, pretty contemporary cool pop
songs. We didn't talk about the bummer version of Save Tonight.
We didn't talk about
episode 5,
that. About the bummer version of I Will Follow You by Leaky Lee that happened in, like, episode 4. And then this time we get a bummer version of Twist and Shout.
Mm-hmm.
That is kind of interesting. I like when TV shows.
It's fun.
It's fun. It's Grey's Anatomy.
It's a fun touch.
I don't think every bummer version works.
That's fair.
I have to admit, I rolled my eyes a little bit about the slow Twist and Shout.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, hearing Twist and Shout again, a nice sort of callback. I sort of like the circular nature of the season and that we started where we ended where we began. We're back in Salal. Mm-hmm. Twist and Shout is playing again. And, you know, it's all sort of like we're back at the 4-4. And then I was like, Twist and Shout, like, maybe I'm going too far and too, like, woo-woo. But I guess it's Twist and that's a circle and there's a spiral and maybe that's part of
We didn't even talk.
Did
Clark literally says time is a flat circle.
He does. Wait, yes, he does.
When he says, well, I mean, when he said that, I yelped.
I thought that moment was perhaps both too on the nose and just an on the nose enough. You know?
I agree. Yeah. I think that
it wasn't
somehow
too much.
It was Schrodinger's quote. Like, I was rolling my eyes, but I was also like, he said the line.
It's like,
And also the way that character was written, I believed he would say that.
Because he is the Matthew McConaughey character, except for now the villain, like the overt villain.
Right. Mm-hmm. Also, I have to confess that this whole time I thought he was played by Hamish Linklater. And then when he started speaking, I was like, that's not Hamish
It wasn't Hamish Linklater.
Yeah. And that's why I kept thinking, not when we recorded this, but I kept being like, well, surely he'll become a big character, because why would Hamish Linklater be on this show?
It's the mayor of Easttown, Brent.
Night Country has got you now.
Oh, no.
Still Watching, we'll be back in just a moment, and when we return, a conversation with Jodie Foster about the ending of True Detective Night Country.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots, I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect. Her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. Okay, wow, 6 hours later, we're at the end of the road of True Detective, and there's a lot to process. There's a lot to talk about.
There is, and there is one, well, there are, there are a few people, I guess, that we could talk to when
there's
we're talking
that I really
about
talk
this
to.
Whole journey. But yes, there's one that we've been dying to talk to, and her name is Jodie Foster, and she is a 2-time Oscar winner. She is joining our podcast.
That's crazy.
Which is really crazy.
Yeah, Jodie Foster doing TV, Jodie Foster doing podcasts. I mean, this is a new Jodie Foster, and I love it.
Brave New World.
And I'm so glad that we were able to talk to her about this really fascinating show that she, you know, produced. And we got a little Clarice Starling, I think, back.
Oh, totally.
So anyway, we're going to talk all about that with Jodie. Enjoy that conversation.
Jodie, thank you so much for joining us. I hope that it's a relief to be able to talk about the entire series at this point. Have you felt like you've been keeping a secret for a long time?
Yes, definitely. And, you know, we love it so much. And honestly, as you know, because you've seen it all, episode 6 is so magnificent that I'm just going like, wait till you get to the end. You know,
when you first got the script, did you see what was coming? Did you see who the killers were, or did it surprise you?
Well, you know, you say yes based on one script, which is the pilot. And then there's a little bit of a log line of, you know, summaries about what potentially could happen in episodes 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. The episode 5 and 6 are like, maybe. So it's sort of a leap of faith. I think that's the way it works here. And having met Issa Lopez, reading her draft, knowing what a great writer she was and what an extraordinary, intelligent, amazing, emotionally connected person that she was. I was like, oh, I want to work with her. So we did change the character quite a bit. And I think that changed other episodes as they went forward.
Can you talk a little bit about how Danvers evolved from that initial pilot to kind of the show that we've seen?
Yeah. The initial pilot, Danvers was, I don't want to say she was a nice person, but I think she was, we really followed her. I think she was grieving and recently grieving because she's younger than me and was, you know, trying to make sense of her life and very emotional. And I just felt like the most important thing was to make sure that Navarro's character was central and that that was the central voice and the central journey of the show. And we sort of re-engineered Danvers backwards and said, okay, how can we support that? What's the opposite way, in a way, to support Navarro's journey? And sometimes that seems like, why would you do that? Why would you? But this is a film rather than, say, a series that will go on for, you know, years and years and years. And it has to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And we really serve the narrative. For us, it was really clear that you know, we wanted to support Navarro's story as much as possible.
On that note, I mean, you told our colleague, Joy Press, that Danvers is kind of an Alaskan Karen, and we definitely see that at the beginning.
Alaskan Karen, even better.
That's even better. Yeah. A good portmanteau.
So, yeah, how do you think that she kind of changes and evolves over these 6 episodes from, like, that initial, you know, at the beginning we see her kind of, you know, being kind of racist, being... Yeah.
Now, look, do people change radically? Most people change incrementally in tiny amounts. I mean, I think that what we learn from her is that all of that rage and bitterness and inability to focus, right? Because she's sort of distracted in the beginning, distracting herself in the beginning, either with Tinder or with fantasy football or, you know, whatever. We want to drill down and find out why is that happening? Why can't this person connect with their daughter and our stepdaughter? And why, what fears is that masking? And I think that's the work of the show, is to sort of open up the Pandora's box by the end and really understand why she is the way that she is, but especially with an older person. You know, it's not like a 20-year-old who's going to change. You're looking at an older person who's stuck in their ways and who's been operating with screensavers, you know, and in survival mode for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And so then at what point in the True Detective production process was the final script written? That, like, you had filming begun already?
Yeah, luckily, Issa had written all the episodes, and, you know, with all the help from the room and all that stuff, had written all the episodes, and then it was just a question of changes. Mm-hmm. You know, and you do changes throughout with notes from the studio and with notes from the producers, and we did film not in continuity, so we're filming maybe the end of the show in the beginning and the middle of the show at the end. Like, we just had to shoot out locations because the locations were so difficult, right? Because of the snow and all that stuff. So it's a big jigsaw puzzle that you hopefully manage to mostly figure out before you step into the shoes of production. But Issa was very busy. So she had to, you know, she had to rewrite stuff as we went and talk to the studios every day and see what was working and what wasn't working.
And when you found out that it was, you know, this collective of Native women, that they are the ones who are responsible for the main murder, I mean, how did you respond to that?
That's the, I mean, when I got the first draft of episode six in, I think I called her and just hollered and screamed because it was so great. I mean, it's just so great. It's my favorite episode. I never saw it coming. As we read through each script, we all said to ourselves, like, wow, we really don't see it coming. And I think that's the beauty of it, is that it sort of throws a mirror at us as an audience of saying, like, all these women were there all along. How is it possible that they were invisible to you? And that's really the story of marginalized people and their lives, is that they are there in front of you. They are living in front of you. There are voices in front of you that go unnoticed or uncared for or unacknowledged. And when you go back in time and you think of all, because you do recognize the women from various different points in the movie, you go back in time and realize, like, oh, that was the, you know, the woman who was cleaning things up in the hospital, and that was the woman who was delivering the ashes at the morgue. And it suddenly pieces together your own lack of accountability and your own implicit bias. I think that we're, we have been engineered by media in some ways to erase marginalized voices. So it's great. It makes the point, and it's thrilling.
Yeah, watching Danvers go from Alaskan to keeping these Native women secret and to sort of creating this, forming this bond with them was really unexpected and very thrilling.
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of Danvers' character, which we can't ignore, is that she's been on the front line for a long time as a police officer, and that's a hard world out there. You know, there's people are getting killed, and very often women are being killed by friends of theirs, by the men in the community that they've grown up with, that are also a part of the community. So it is a very complicated, very, very complicated and painful part of rural life, not just in the United States, not just in the upper, you know, northern Alaska, but also in Latin America and all over the world, that missing and murdered women is such a huge part of the heartbreak of marginalized societies.
It must have been a very difficult shoot in a lot of ways, you know, thematically and also just physically. You're in the dark, you're in the cold. What was this last episode? You know, you're falling into the ice, you're in these
in the
caves.
Water again. It's crazy.
Yeah, tell us about filming this last episode and what the trickiest moments were.
Yeah, that was hard. I kept asking, because we actually shot that like the last few days of shooting, mostly because they hadn't figured it out yet. Like, how are we going to do the falling through the ice? I kept saying that, I think, from week one. Hey, by the way, have we figured out how we're going to do the falling through the ice?
Yeah.
We all knew from experience that it was going to have to be a tank. We're going to have to build a tank, because there was no way, obviously, that you could ever shoot in real ice and be able to control that, or the light. Or any number of things. So it was just a question of what it was that we had to build. And for me, that was it was a big challenge in the show for me, because I'm wearing coats, but I had to have a wetsuit on, and it had to be weighted in order for me to be able to fall and to kind of do this without popping up to the top. But the problem was that, of course, it's dark. I can't wear glasses. I'm completely blind. And the surface had to have the ice there. So that's, the ice is not ice. It's like a plastic, you know, there are pieces of things that I can't get through. So the only way to get to the top is a very small, narrow little window, which I can't see. And I can't get myself up because I'm weighted, so heavily weighted. So I did have a free diver that we worked with a little bit before shooting, and, you know, teaching you how to breathe properly so you have maximum oxygen in your lungs. But he had to, you know, as soon as they basically said cut, he had to rush in and grab me and pull me up to the surface, because there was no way I could get up to the surface on my own. So Yeah, that was scary.
Yeah, that sounds very dangerous and very scary.
Yeah, I spoke to Kaylee and she mentioned, you know, doing her own stunts and her own fights and everything because she's a boxer. But I mean, from your perspective, where you were also like, I'm game, like, let's do this? Or were you nervous?
Yeah, I mean, there's certain things. I think that, first of all, our stunt people were amazing from England. They were just amazing and so into it. Like, they were so into it and so, so enthusiastic and great. They recognize I also have, like, you know, a torn ACL from skiing and stuff. So they recognize there were things that I definitely shouldn't do, you know. So you will notice, you know, Kaylee, like, falls through a thing and lands on her back and then, like, all this stuff. And then somewhere in the background, I sort of delicately come down. You know, they took care of me. They took care of me.
As they should. Can you talk a little bit about working with Kaylee? I mean, she does such a phenomenal job, but she's sort of a new to the acting profession, and you're such a veteran. What was that like working with someone so fresh?
Oh, I just love her so much. Nobody works harder than Kaylee. She's got all of that discipline, that athlete's discipline. She's willing to do something over and over and over again before she gets it right and give every single time 100%, which I think really it's a mindset, right? It's so much more about a mindset than anything else. She had a really, really, really tough, I mean, that's a tough shoot for her. She's on every single day and she had a lot of work that she had to do as an actor, but also, you know, training. And we worked on weekends very often doing rehearsals on Saturdays. So she really only got one day off on Sunday, and that was in the dark, you know? I think it was really tough. I think the toughest thing on her really was just being away from home and being away from friends for so long. 7 months is a long time, and as much as we loved Reykjavik, you know, you miss your mom, and, you know, you miss your dog. She had a puppy. They got a puppy while she was away, and she could see pictures of the puppy. But having never met the puppy...
Wow.
So I think that was hard on her, but I just adore her, and I'm in awe of her. I mean, she did such an amazing job. She really holds the screen. It's like a magic trick that she has, that she's on screen and you just can't look at anything else.
Still watching. We'll be back in just a moment. And when we return, more with Jodie Foster on True Detective.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
How do you interpret the very ending where we see Danvers and Navarro together? I mean, there's potential ambiguity, like maybe one of them's a ghost, maybe, who knows, it's Ennis, nobody ever really leaves. Yeah, what was your take on that?
Well, I'm not gonna have a take. I mean, I think it could be any of those things. I believe that, I mean, you know, knowing the characters the way I do, I feel like they are destined to struggle for their whole lives. And I think especially Kaylee's character, she is between two worlds. So she's not only between, as a biracial person, you know, in between two cultures, being in the police force, but also really identifying with the victims and the people that are in the community. But she also lives between the world of the dead and the world of the living, in a way. And that's sort of her destiny, is to always be in limbo and always be having to struggle to figure out which side she belongs on. So I guess I like to think that that will always be true of her. As she lives her life, that she will be struggling about which side she belongs on.
Yeah, we were sort of debating whether it's kind of a bleak ending or a hopeful one. And I guess you're saying it's sort of right there in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hopeful. I think it's bittersweet, which is, I mean, it's this, weirdly, it's the same thing as Silence of the Lambs, weirdly, which is, you know, it was Clarice's destiny to be that archetypal character who will always be hearing the bleating of the lambs, you know, and will always be out there trying to protect and save women that look just like her. Mm. And that never ends, that kind of fate. And there is a sort of tragic quality to this show and to True Detective. In going back to season one, both of them are resigned that their messed up parts are probably not going to change, you know, that they have this destiny, like they can't help it. They're just going to go back and sadly do the same thing that they did before that was a mistake. Mm-hmm. And do you feel like that's sort of a tragic, in the good sense of the word, sort of Greek tragic way that things go?
It's really interesting that you drew a parallel between Clarice Starling and Navarro, Kaylee's character, because we sort of drew a parallel between Clarice and Peter, right? As sort of the upstart, you know, fresh new face on the force. Yeah. Does that ring true at all, or were we so off base?
Yeah, I think it does, actually. Sure, why not? And so interesting that he's a guy and I'm a girl, you know? And that still works, you know, that the protege, what the idea of protege is, that there's a bond and an intimacy between the protege relationship and the mentee relationship, or the mentor and the mentee relationship. And, there's something terrible about the fact that your mentor is forcing you in some ways to isolate yourself from your real life. Isolate yourself from the real world, because you can't do the job well unless you do. But then, is that what you're hoping for them? You know, you're hoping for them to be isolated from the real world. I think that there is a parallel there.
Yeah, and that he has to, you know, literally, you know, kill his father in order to kind of become his own man, which I guess is sort of the oldest story, but...
Yeah, the oldest story in the world. Yeah, you don't get any more Greek tragedy than that. That moment for me was so, so deep and difficult, right? Where John Hawke's character dies at the hands of his son. And we agonized about that more than anything else in the entire show. You know, how it should be done, where it should be done, what should be said, what shouldn't be said, who reacts a certain way. I think that was probably the hardest hurdle we ever had to get over. And then once we found it, we were like, yes.
What were the alternate versions? Were there versions in which like Danvers or Navarro were the ones to pull the trigger?
No. Not really. I think we always knew that that was the right thing, but we were like, how do we make it feel truthful, and what would be the real reaction, and does he fear that his dad is going to come in and kill Danvers? It had to be an impulse, right? Because you don't do that without it being impulsive. And yet everything that Danvers is about is thinking, not feeling. So she had to continually be telling him, think. Don't let your feelings get in the way. Think about what the right path is. Do the, you know, use your brain. That is sadly Danvers' superpower, right? Mm-hmm. And Navarro's the opposite. Navarro is all instinct. And that's why they make such a good team.
It was interesting what you were saying before about how the two of them are kind of destined to be, you know, making the same mistakes over and over, because it does recall, you know, the most famous True Detective quote, time is a flat circle. And that's a quote that we see in this episode. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, how Issa worked that into the episode and what it was like filming that scene?
Issa's a huge fan of the show and is a great movie fan, you know, so she understands references and she's seen every film, you know, ever made. So it was important to her to pay homage to that first season. I mean, and the whole, you know, as the anthology goes, we all pay homage to the first season. You know, sometimes you think of the time as a flat circle really as just sort of Matthew McConaughey's character, kind of philosophical, you know, going on one of his out-of-body philosophical things. Mm-hmm. But for me, I think it is sort of part of what we know about character, that characters repeat themselves, you know, they repeat parts of their process that comes from their childhoods and from their various wounds in life, that you can't escape that. And that's, you know, that's just once again, tragedy 101.
Mm-hmm. It does seem sort of funny, though. I feel like Danvers is kind of frustrated when he says that because it sort of sounds like this metaphysical, like, very not her world. Like you said, yes. She is very, like, literal, practical.
Practical, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, she's practical because she's afraid. Mm-hmm. She doesn't trust anything else, and she is afraid that if she opens to the possibility of instinct, that it'll hurt. Because it does. Being human and having feelings and being attached and continuing to love people is painful. And she's just, that's her one motivation is, you know, how do I avoid pain? Mm-hmm.
We see that so brilliantly with the Holden subplot. And when you're, you know, you're sort of at death's door talking to Navarro and you find you reopen that wound. And the show, Issa, it's really sort of just gestured at. It's not overly explained exactly what happened and whatnot. Can you talk about that arc and that part of the story?
Yeah, we had a lot of discussions back and forth about, like, you know, how much do we go into about the past? And we know the story, so we know what happened. How much do we go into the past? And how much do we talk about Jake? So her ex-husband, and in what capacity do we talk about Jake? And why is it that she doesn't grieve Jake? Mm-hmm. You know, why is it that she just grieves Holden? Is it because Jake did something terrible? Is it because Jake was a drunk driver, you know, any number of things that it could be. And some of that will remain mysterious to the audience, but I think they can still feel the pain behind it. The pain of being in that relationship, for example, with her ex-husband, and she didn't want to have kids. She was too old to have kids, but they decided to anyway. And they were an on again, off again. They were, you know, breaking up because she's difficult. We know she's difficult. So yeah, I'd break up with her too. She's difficult. And we also know that you don't grieve people the same. And there are some relationships, not that you get over, but that have closure. And there are some relationships where it's impossible to find closure. And maybe that comes from need. You know, it's hard to let go of your mom if you're still wrapped up in your mom's appreciation of what you do. And if you don't know how to pay a bill and your mom person to pay a bill, or like some of that is wrapped up in need. And for whatever reason, she has not been able to kind of metabolize Holden's passing. There are unanswered questions there about responsibility and about unsaid things, you know, about not having had the opportunity to metabolize that, which I think is very true of people with young children that go because they haven't fulfilled their relationship with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on a lighter note, a recurring theme of the season is how many people in Ennis Danvers has slept with, which is such like a funny. it's such a funny
it's
like
a
running
town, you know?
Running joke. Yeah, tell us about that aspect of it. I mean, did you enjoy it? It seems like you guys are always having fun on screen when we find another one.
Yeah, I mean, I like being the brunt of the joke. It's really at. It's at Danvers' expense, you know, which I think is just great that she's sort of unremorseful about it. It's like, yeah. What do you expect me to do? Who cares? What do I care?
There's nothing else to do. It's dark all the time.
Right, right. And sort of rolling her eyes at everybody's pearl clutching, which I just thought was fresh and fun and complex. That is one thing that Issa really is able to do. And not surprisingly, I think it's very unusual to see such fully fleshed, complex female characters that have lots of contradictions. That's what happens when you have a woman director writer, mm-hmm. right? The reality of women's lives, the complexity of women's lives is finally seen on screen. And we're just not used to seeing women that way because honestly, we're very used to seeing our voices and our characters being drawn by men. I mean, I used to say this, like, it just amazes me throughout my lifetime, the amount of scripts that I would get where the entire motivation for the character was almost always she was raped. Mm. Like, it's amazing to me. Like, you guys couldn't think of anything else? Mm-hmm. You guys can't imagine that a woman would have deep flaws or deep issues or be visited by trauma other than that? Like, that's it? That's like the only one?
Well, and that's still so true. That's still true so frequently for female characters, especially on TV, on like prestige shows.
Yeah, it's annoying. And I'm not one who's, and I will point it out, you know, it's just not, it's nobody's fault, I think, because a lot of directors are not taught to inhabit the characters of women. Somehow they can manage to inhabit the characters of their male characters, but it's hard for men to inhabit the bodies of women and say, oh, I'm inhabiting the body. What do I see? What do I feel? What does that look like? You know, they're just not used to doing it. So they don't have an idea of what that feels like. And women have to, right? We have to inhabit everybody.
Yes.
Like our kids and other people and people that don't look like that. We have to do that all the time. If you're a writer, you're a director, you know, you're continually, you have to be able to ask questions of people that don't look like you, that don't have your experience.
Sounds like we need more female directors.
As we kind of wrap up, what do you hope is kind of, you know, the legacy of this season? What do you want people to take away from it?
Well, I'm so proud of it. I mean, I'm just so happy to be a part of something. Like, that's really been the great gift of being an older person, being in your 60s, is you have to recognize that it's not your time. You had your time. Now I get to support other people's time and I get to be the one who has some kind of wisdom. I don't know what kind of wisdom I have. I mean, you know, the wisdom of like, chill out. It's all going to be okay. But I am really excited about people discovering a different community in the United States that they don't see very often and hearing voices that they don't see centered and really having to walk in the shoes of Native people's lives and as a centered characters. I think that's really exciting. And even though there's been a lot of representation in the last couple of years, really, with Native people, like, representation is okay, but that's like saying, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
it's not everything.
Yeah, just totally.
It's not okay to just see faces and then pat yourself on the back and say, oh, we know what their lives are like. That's not how it works. You actually have to center the characters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And show that, yeah, they're not a monolith. There's so many different sorts of stories. Yeah.
Yeah. And for us, it's like, also what's sort of interesting, I love this about the writer as well, is like, you kind of don't know who's Native and who isn't, right? In some moments you're like, oh, well, okay. But when you're looking at the population of this area in North Alaska, it's about 75 to 80% Native. But what does that mean? Not everybody's the same, you know, just because they're Inupiaq doesn't mean, or they have a Inupiaq tradition. There's all sorts of ways of having that ancestry.
It's really refreshing to see, to spend so much time with a swath of people that we don't normally get to spend time with on screen.
That are living a life we can't even imagine. I mean, can you imagine living a life where there's no roads? Like, there's almost no roads into Nome and into Arctic Circle. So everything you get comes in on a boat. Like, you got to wait months. If you want a phone charger, months.
I couldn't live that way.
Or a new piece of equipment. And then to have, you know, the long days in the summer and then the short, the long nights in the winter, or having to supplement your whole food system, right, with seal and walrus and snow crabs, and because Oreos cost $30 a pop.
Unbelievable.
So, yeah, so it's just a different life, I think, than we understand as it's an American life.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you. So great.
Bye.
Thank you.
Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment. When we return, we're going to figure out which host got the most guesses right and who wins. It's me. She's awake.
Hillary's awake. All right, so it's time now. We've been making predictions every episode. So we, you know, have a pretty vast array over 5 episodes of who we think did it. Chris was high on his polar bear theory for a while.
There's an argument to be made.
I was high on my gas theory for a while. I still think sort of it was environmental. But I think that, you know, so last week I had stuck with gas and that Annie Kay actually died from gas, but she was, they staged it like a murder, so because they didn't want environmental stuff to come out.
well, if the gas weren't so important to the scientist that killed her, then maybe then maybe she'd be alive.
Look, I gotta tell you, there is no gas, Richard.
No, the gas thing is wrong.
I'm sorry, Richard. I do think you have to get 0 points.
No, I get 0 points. Chris, you mentioned Connolly as the killer of Annie Kay. You mentioned Kate being involved in that. Hillary, not quite right. But both of you kind of envisioned someone local to the town getting revenge. Mm-hmm. And you were both right on that front. I kind of think you guys win.
We didn't, yeah. We sort of split the difference. Because I said the indigenous community, but I said the wrong faction of the indigenous community.
You assumed it would be men.
And you said women.
But I said white women.
The doctor is his mother, Chris.
That says a lot about both of us, Hillary.
He was standing on a block of ice.
Yeah.
Okay, but I do also want to shout us back to episode 1 predictions. Because, you know what? I said that it's always the boyfriend for Annie Kay. And it was the boyfriend.
And technically, he was the one who...
He was literally the one who did the final murder.
So I do think in this tiebreaker, nail-biter of a competition, I do think you get the edge for that. I ultimately do.
I'm so proud.
I'll cede it to you.
This is really a victory for all women. I want to...
Please take the floor. Speak for all women, please.
That's what we love to do.
So we will be buying Hillary an icy or Slurpee.
Yes, ICs are actually
choosing.
Disgusting. I'm gonna pass because I'm a 35-year-old woman. I don't want that in my life.
Right. I'll just put some white wine in a freezer. But,
you know, Grigio
that is
good.
That is rose coated. Okay, so looking past this season of True Detective into a possible future for the franchise. First of all, do we see a future for True Detective? There are so many more crime dramas than there were when True Detective first emerged in 2015. It's become, you know, it's a saturated market, especially for star-driven projects like this on prestige streamers and prestige networks. Do you think that this season has kind of breathed life into this franchise again? Does it feel like True Detective still has its own kind of brand within this bigger sea of crime shows?
I do think so, because while we keep talking about Mare of Easttown, I think that's probably the best corollary in terms of like a big budget, it's big budget, it's HBO, it's prestige-y, it has all of the trappings, but it does ultimately feel a little bit different because, and this isn't a dig at Mare of Easttown, it felt a little bit more procedurally, it feels a little bit more of that vein, whereas this, at least the season, leaned more into the supernatural, into sort
it
of
almost
bigger
felt, yeah,
questions.
In Mare, you really want to know the answer to the who did the murder. I feel like in this, you cared less.
Yeah, it was less, it was, yeah,
and
I totally
more,
agree
it's more
that.
About Navarro and Danvers.
Yeah, and them getting through their trauma. And we had maybe less specific, clear-cut answers to certain questions in this than we got in A Mare of Easttown. So for me, I like true crime. I like the genre. I thought this was a, it's hard for me to say return to form as I didn't watch seasons 2 and 3, but I think it justified its existence. Mm-hmm. And I would be curious to see what a different, though I would say it'd be maybe fun to get a different person to do the next season and take it in a completely different direction.
I think that could be really cool. I think new locations, I think take a little page from White Lotus.
Right.
Like I think, I mean, the first 3 seasons were all different locations too, but I think that they were less distinct from one another.
Yeah.
And I think this is so far afield. I'm not saying that the next season has to be set in the Mojave Desert or whatever, but like, you know.
Well, that actually was season 2.
Yes, that kind of was season 2. You're right. Yeah, yeah.
But no, we're not going to like the rainforest.
Right, yeah. So I think that could be an interesting thing. But yeah, I think that the brand recognition is strong. I mean, to be cynical about it, that if you find a writer who wants to write an interesting 6-episode murder mystery under the True Detective umbrella, I think as long as there are certain things, certain tones, certain thematic stuff like the spiral and the time is a flat circle, as long as it feels somewhat bound by the vague world of True Detective, there's so much room to play in. And mm-hmm. I think that's encouraging. And I think that's the kind of TV I want to see more of. And then you go from 6 episodes to 4 to 3 to 2, and then you were making movies again.
Then we might even have a movie.
Wouldn't that be fun?
I was like, where are you going?
I don't know, a detective murder mystery movie, you know?
Been done before.
Kenneth Branagh is making them right now.
Oh, well, that's true, I suppose, isn't it?
But yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that this did a good job of both being similar enough to the Nick Pizzolatto seasons while carving out its own niche and yeah, like showing the ways in which this brand, like for lack of a better word, can continue and can broaden its scope.
So more True Detective, please.
And more from Issa Lopez, I want to say.
Yeah,
also.
I would love
100%.
To see. Yeah. Really.
Because it's really rare, I think, to, you know, she's making her first project in English. Like, it's really rare to have somebody, their first thing on American television, just be this, like, well structured and thought out, and you know it's a tricky tonal mix, and it's really well it's really beautifully shot, and yeah, I really want to know what other stories she wants to tell.
Yeah,
lots of like interesting poetic language, and like which is you know part of the True Detective brand, obviously, but I think it also feels distinctly of her voice. It did not sound like Pizzolatto to me. Yeah, absolutely. I hope that this is like her calling card now, and she gets her blank check for her next.
Yeah, I want to know like when she's not working like under the auspices of an already existing show, like what's she going to make?
Maybe we'll cover it on this very podcast. Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. Now that True Detective is over, don't worry. We still have a special bonus episode about True Detective brewing. We're talking to showrunner Issa Lopez next week.
We have a lot of questions. Yeah. We want to know about the tongue.
Want to know about the tongue, her love of oranges.
We want to know how supernatural the supernatural really is. We want to know about filming in those ice caves.
Yeah.
I want to know where she gets her ideas. Honestly, I do. Like, this is an intricate thing to put together, and she did it. So
We want to know how she thinks that the men at the Dietlov Pass actually died.
Yeah.
Oh, that's first question.
Yeah, we got to ask.
Yeah, maybe we'll spend the whole hour on that. I don't know.
Was there a tongue involved in that incident? We don't
have to listen.
But yeah, so we're going to talk to her. We're going to get the answers. And in the meantime, Richard?
You can find me on social media as ever. I'm at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me on social media at Christress.
And I'm at Hillabuster. This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next week with a special bonus episode talking to showrunner Issa Lopez. See you soon.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
From PRX.